I'm Right, the podcast that uncovers the origin stories of some of the biggest names in sports, media, and entertainment. Nick Durst here along with Joe Calabrese. And Joe, our guest today, he knows a thing or two about sports and media and entertainment, wouldn't you say?
I'd say so. When we think of anything related to sports marketing, representation, super sports agents. If anybody's ever seen the movie Jerry Maguire, his life story is the backbone and the inspiration for that movie. He's got 5 decades in the business. He's the chairman of the board of Steinberg Sports and Entertainment, a best-selling author, somebody who probably needs no further introduction from us. We welcome Lee Steinberg to the program. Lee, it is an honor. How are you?
Happy to be with you.
So let's talk about your early life. Attending UCLA, attending University of California, Berkeley, getting your education there. When did you know that you wanted to kind of pursue this path?
There really was not an organized field of sports agentry when I began in 1975. There was no collective bargaining right that a player had to have an agent. So teams didn't have any obligation to talk to someone representing a player and could just slam the phone down. So I had gone to school at Cal, undergrad and law school. I was student body president when Ronald Reagan was governor, and the war in Vietnam was going on, and we were demonstrating and he was cracking down, and I learned everything I needed to learn about the art of leverage and negotiating from dealing with then governor, later President Reagan. I was a dorm counselor in an undergraduate dorm, and they moved the freshman football team into that dorm. And one of the students was the quarterback, Steve Bartkowski, and he became the very first player picked in the 1975 NFL draft by the Atlanta Falcons. And I was choosing between different law jobs at that point. I'd graduated a year earlier and was traveling around the world. And Bartkowski asked me if I could represent him. So there I was, brimming with legal experience, never having practiced law before. And my first client was Bartkowski. And there was a World Football League competing against the NFL with teams like the Shreveport Steamer and the Chicago Wind. And so we had leverage, and he got the largest rookie contract in NFL history. And I still was not sure I'd do this as a career, but when we arrived at the airport, there were Klieg lights flashing in the sky the night before the signing. There was a huge crowd pressed up against a police line, and the first thing we heard was, "We interrupt the late news to bring you a special bulletin. Steve Bartkowski and his attorney have just arrived at the Atlanta airport. We switch you live for an in-depth interview." So I saw the idol worship and veneration that athletes were held in communities across the country. They were the movie stars. They were the celebrity. And my dad had raised me with two core values. One was treasure relationships, especially family. And the second was try to make a meaningful difference in the world and help people who couldn't help themselves. In other words, be an agent of change. So I saw that athletes could fill this role serving as role models and retrace back to the high school, collegiate, and professional community. So again, those early days were very rudimentary because it was the wild, wild west, but eventually it turned into a different business.
Yeah, and obviously you got to keep track of all the stuff going on and all the different rules that they're always changing with the NFL. Did your fellow dorm mate Steve Wozniak hook you up with a computer to keep track of all this stuff?
That's really funny. The same year that Bartkowski lived in a dorm, Steve Wozniak lived in it, and he would set everybody's phones ringing in ways they could never turn off, and I had a very rambunctious dorm.
So talk to us about starting Steinberg Sports and Entertainment. What was the type of foundational work that had to go into putting that all together?
So the first year I had signed the top player, got the biggest contract ever. And I came out in the second year and went to a lot of bowl games, did a lot of things to meet players. And I had reasonable results, but not like Bartkowski. And I realized I would have to refocus and alter that modality so that instead of talking to 100% of the players, I could profile the players that had a good heart, social conscience, high character, had a pristine work ethic. And if I talked to them and their parents, I would have a much better chance than talking to 100% of the players. So I started to do that. And to be effective as someone representing athletes, you need an infrastructure that does three things: helps recruit them, helps negotiate for them, helps maintain them as clients. And so it turned that I went around and spoke at 85 college campuses. So I established a system where I knew the football secretaries, I knew the trainers, I knew a whole bunch of different people. And then I've probably given 4,000 speeches, so that I've talked to the people in the general community and charities and civic groups over and over again. So that all was sort of necessary. And when I started, I was using the table in my parents' card room, and I was my own secretary. I answered the phone. Back then, you won't believe this, guys, but there was a rotary phone.
Yep.
And yep. If you were on it and someone called, it sounded busy. So it was back in those days, and I typed my own letters and did everything. That changed as we grew. But, you know, before we knew it, at the end of it, we'd had 64 first-round draft picks in football, the very first pick in the draft in 8 different years, and 12 of the players in the Hall of Fame, and then a big baseball practice and basketball, and fighters like Lennox Lewis and Oscar De La Hoya and Olympic athletes. So it continued to spread. But the key skill in all this is listening. Can you draw out another human being and cut below the surface responses to delve into their deepest anxieties and fears and their greatest hopes and dreams? And then can you put yourself in another person's heart and mind to see the world the way they see it? And then you can gracefully go through life. So it was trying to get a deeper sense of what would fulfill a player. It was like, how do they feel about short-term economic gain, long-term economic security, family, being a starter, being on a winning team? How did that constellation of values fit together for them?
So I'm curious about, after you have your first influx of players, and then let's say in the 80s and 90s, they start to retire, and they came to you and probably said, hey, I want to maybe try this TV thing, right? How did your business perhaps change for you when you get to players that start retiring and now they're saying, well, I want to make a transition? How were you able to facilitate or help in that aspect?
By in the very first meeting I ever had with a player, asking them what other skills and talents they had that they'd like to explore. So if it was business, we would get them to network. So I had a couple of players on the 49ers, Steve Young and Brent Jones. And I would say, what business or industry is proximate to Santa Clara where you train that you could make contacts in? You know, get someone's card, have a discussion with them, network. And so it, well, just high tech and venture capital. So it's not by chance that both Brent Jones and Steve Young ended up being the head of a venture fund. Or Bruce Smith, the all-time sack leader, a construction company. Or with Troy Aikman, he knew the broadcast was his eventual goal, so let's have him go do NFL Europe. So we were constantly doing things before the career. So if we'd done this correctly, no one would ever say to me, well, now I'm retired, I have to do that. We'd already been talking about it since they were a rookie.
Makes a lot of sense. Now, you mentioned Steve Young, and this story has recently been coming out heavily, but tell us about the time where he puked his red Gatorade all over you after winning the Super Bowl and the Super Bowl MVP.
So Steve had been in the shadow of Joe Montana. And like every younger brother who's in the shadow of the older brother, it's frustrating, but he was a good soldier. So he goes out in the Super Bowl played in Miami in 1994, and they played against the Chargers, and he throws six touchdown passes. They completely confuse it. It's a rout. And he's MVP. So I run up to him after the game, and he hugs me and he says, "The monkey's off my back, the monkey's off my back." So it was a fun moment. But then I told him, "Why don't you do all these interviews?" And he never got hydrated. So he's doing an innumerable number of stand-up interviews for a couple hours. And then we get in the limo on the way back. And Kerry Collins, who later played for the Giants and the Panthers, was a rookie, so he's watching all this. And we're going back to the hotel in Miami. And Steve says, "I really don't feel well." And I really don't feel well. And all of a sudden, he upchucked all over Kerry Collins and my shoes. You know, we'll never wash those shoes again. But and then we get back to the hotel, and he's on an IV, and he's lying there like it was the Last Supper or something, you know, with all the downstairs. You can hear the jubilation and the big party breaking loose, and seated up there on IV. So that was that Super Bowl.
Yeah. So obviously, you've done. To been to most Super Bowl, most Super Bowls are more than the majority of Super Bowls at this time. So I want to know about Radio Row. Obviously, you were there when it was just Mike and the Mad Dog, and it was just them. And obviously now it's like so intense and everybody is doing this and that. So for you, how far in advance are you putting those deals together for your clients as far as like, all right, you're going to promote this, you're going to promote that? Is it as soon as that team that they're on gets eliminated? What's the process there?
You would like to anticipate what's coming. So we used to take on Radio Row our rookies to raise their profiles. So like you take a Patrick Mahomes or a Tua, or you take a young player, and they could surf the country because you'd start with Miami and then Jacksonville and then Tampa and then Orlando and then Atlanta and Charlotte, and you just little by little. So it was a way to raise profile. Myself, I do interviews. My record is 71 talk radio and TV interviews down there.
Oh my gosh.
Here I did about 50. But people want to talk about what the marketing is around the Super Bowl. They want to talk about how it changes the life of the winning quarterback. And, you know, so I've had, as winners, Troy won three. Steve Young won one, Ben Roethlisberger won a couple, and now Patrick's won three. And then I've had notable losing quarterbacks too.
Well, they're not all winners. I mean, under your umbrella, sure, they're all winners, but you can't all win the Super Bowl. Let's talk about those famous Super Bowl parties. What parties in your mind stand out more so than others? Any particular celebrities and people attended that you can remember, and some memorable stories off the top of your head?
So, first of all, I try to pick an iconic venue. So an example would be, we use Sony Studios, where they actually made Jerry Maguire, for the party in Los Angeles a couple years ago. We've had, Rob Schneider come dressed as Richard Simmons, only he was the bad Richard Simmons, the exercise guru, and he got drunk and ate ding-dongs. And so Richard Simmons was a guest on Jay Leno, so he came that night. We've had Cuba Gooding Jr. run across the party yelling, "Show me the money." It's done for a charitable cause. So last year was the homeless. This year was Special Olympics. And we're trying to raise consciousness. So it's a party. And you're going to see celebrities, the Real Housewives of Atlanta or NSYNC, whatever's hot that year, I tried to program. But this year we had a brain body lounge, which showed off hyperbaric oxygen, stem cells, a whole bunch of healing modalities that can get players more quickly into to recover and prophylactically protect them. We had a concussion seminar, which is about the 30th, because I've been since the 90s pushing really hard for awareness, prevention, and cure. So we had about our 30th concussion conference with neurologists and people there. We did a celebrity poker tournament with Jamie Gold, the winner of the World Series, and Phil Hellmuth, who's a famous person. We did a esports competition where we had Michigan play Michigan State. And then we do humanitarian awards for a owner, a general manager, people that do positive things in football. So it's sort of fun. Who's been there? Kevin Costner, Jennifer Lopez, Jamie Foxx. People in music, people in other sports, wrestler. I mean, it's the Super Bowl, if you will, is a convention of Americana, big business, politics, sports, and entertainment, and all.
Which city would you say is the best host for the Super Bowl? What kind of makes everything flow the best?
I think that we don't have San Diego anymore, but they were an excellent city. Miami shows well. New Orleans, which will have it next year, is just built for it. Las Vegas was built for the Super Bowl. Yeah. Like everything you possibly could need there. Los Angeles was a really good host. San Francisco is a good host. I was not excited when we did our last one in Minneapolis, and on the morning of the party it's -7 degrees,
too cold,
snowing.
Yeah,
so I'm not all that excited about cold weather cities for the Super Bowl. I was even cold in Las Vegas this year in a relative sense, but then I'm from Southern California, so I'm probably a wimp.
Yeah, well, I'm sure there'll be plenty more Super Bowls in Las Vegas and at SoFi Stadium moving forward here. Two great state-of-the-art venues for sure. So you mentioned him a few times, obviously, but Patrick Mahomes won the Super Bowl again. So just curious here, when you guys inked that deal, the extension originally, I don't need the details of how it went about, but just like, How did it go when you broke the news to Patrick? Was there like a sense of relief? Were you all very excited? Just what kind of euphoria came after that deal was closed for the contract extension?
Oh, he's never been all that worried about this is about contracts. This is someone who's so focused on trying to win more Super Bowls. And so he's got those two sides of him. The other side is a generous philanthropist who's got 15 in the Mahomes, which helps at-risk kids, kids in hospitals, kids with special needs. So that side, and he's handled the whole thing beautifully.
So I want to talk about somebody very special to Nick and I, very special to me, your former CEO, Dave Meltzer. Now, I first met him a couple of years ago, and I've had some trials and tribulations of my life, and he's been there for me through the past couple of years, through some really, really dark periods. So I want to talk to you about when you first met him, your working relationship with him, and how you've been happy and proud for his success from the time that you first met him through his trials and tribulations, and ultimately seeing the person that he ultimately became right now.
So, David had been in San Diego and had been involved in several things, but immediately I was struck by his creativity. He had a lot of charm and warmth, had vision, could see the world in the future. And so I made him CEO here, which he did for several years. And then when I was having problems because of alcohol and went through sort of a crash, he and Warren Moon put together an organization that did marketing. And now David's on his own, and I'm very proud of him. He's become a worldwide success and had an impact on a lot of people's lives.
Proud teacher, proud student. Again, he's very, very important to me and very, very special person. Whenever he's in New York, I always come to see him. So I'll show him this clip and hopefully he enjoys it. Let's talk about overcoming alcoholism, right? And the philanthropy work that you do, turning your struggles, we all have demons, so turning your life experiences ultimately into a positive, something that could help benefit those who are in a similar position, those who are battling those same demons. You know, my father, he battled alcoholism for a really, really long time. You know, unfortunately, he's not in the best position at this point of his life, but thankfully he's still with us. So just explain what you went through, how you got through it, and eventually using those experiences to help other people.
So alcoholism snuck up on me, and part of it's denial. It's a disease that makes you say you don't have a disease. And before I knew it, it became not a matter of choice whether or not I drank. And you have to hit a certain bottom. And so at one point, I closed up my office. I closed my condo and basically said, look, if nothing else in this lifetime, I'm going to be sober. And I'll be a good parent to my children and a good friend. Anything else happens, that's a cherry on the top. So I went into a 12-step program with a unique fellowship, and I worked those 12 steps, got a sponsor, found a home group, and gradually was able, by focusing on sobriety first, was able to get to the point where about 3 years in, I felt like I was solid enough, although it takes maintenance, and started a firm again, and that led to the present day. But if someone's out there and they're struggling, despondent, disillusioned, depressed because of problems with addictive substances, just know there is help. And I've been public about my alcoholism in the hopes that it helps someone else, because when you're in that dark tunnel, it's hard to see light at the end of it. And so I've worked really hard, and in a couple of weeks, I'll celebrate my 14th year of continuous sobriety.
Job well done. Keep fighting the battle. You're doing a great job so far. And like Joe said, also doing some great work with the philanthropy stuff and always giving back, especially with the Super Bowl parties. So we commend you for that, as well as many people do.
So look, I had a father who said, when you're looking for someone to solve a problem, as minor as picking a piece of paper up off the floor, or as big as racism or climate change, he said your tendency will to be wait for they or them, the amorphous they, political figures, older people, to solve it. And he would say, son, you could wait forever. The they is you. You are the they. So I've always felt like, whether it was racism or climate change or bullying or sex trafficking or any of the problems, domestic violence, that we could find a way to use sports to set better models. And we could use athletes. So you have Lennox Lewis do a public service announcement that says, real men don't hit women. And that could do more to trigger imitative behavior in rebellious adolescents who don't listen to authority figures than 1,000 authority figures ever could, or Oscar De La Hoya and Steve Young, prejudice is foul play. So little by little, we've tried to use sports where if there's a bullying problem in a high school, well, if you can get the athletes and the coaches behind changing the culture, because the athletes sit on top of the food chain, you can do it real quick. So I've done work with high schools where we change bullying into tolerance.
That's great. Awesome stuff. Now, we've talked about it a few times, so you're already touching it, but Jerry Maguire, obviously, well known for that. What was your thought process when the writers, the producers, whatever, came to you and were like, hey, we want to maybe shadow you a little bit or consult with you. We're making this film. And what was your reaction when it's kind of played out in all these years? I'm sure it gets brought up to you daily.
I think somewhere behind me is a picture from Jerry Maguire with Tom Cruise and Cuba Gooding.
Yeah.
Cameron came to me in 1993 and he said, would you allow me to follow you around for a film that I want to do that will center on a sports agent? So I'd like to be a fly on the wall. I want you to tell me stories about your experiences. So we started with that and went to the league meetings in Palm Desert where I was showing off potential free agents. Then he went back to the draft in 93 where Drew Bledsoe was the first pick and my client. He went to the press conference with Bill Parcells. He went to pro scouting day with me at SC, came to a series of games, went to my Super Bowl parties. He saw a lot and I told him a lot of stories. And so then I was technical advisor. So one of my roles was to vet the script to make sure that the willing suspension of disbelief that holds you in the picture so you're not thinking it's phony or stilted is present. And then he had me take actors like Cuba Gooding Jr. I took him down to the Super Bowl in Phoenix and made him pretend he was a wide receiver client for the whole week to put him in role. And he hung out with Desmond Howard and Amani Toomer, just like he was just a client down for the game. And actually had to show Jerry O'Connell, who played the quarterback, how to throw a spiral because he had gone to NYU and they didn't have a football program there. So it's been 26 years and I can't go to an airport or out to dinner without someone running up and either asking me to say the four words or saying those four words that start with show me the
money. Show me the money. Amazing stuff. Amazing stuff. Let's talk more about your company, right? Paying it forward to the next generation. What is it like keeping everything within your close family, working with your son, Matthew, meeting people who are like-minded, right? Who operate on the same level that you do, and taking, whether it's an athlete or somebody who works directly with you, taking them through that process of where they start, helping them become better people, helping them become better people after the fact, and turning people into stars. You know, would you consider the next generation like Nick and I? And how do you deal with people like us who are looking to get to that next level and the next big break?
So we set up a program called the Agent Academy, where we take young people and teach them listening skills and then how to recruit. So they do an exercise where they have to recruit Warren Moon or Patrick Mahomes and his family. Then we teach them how to negotiate, half of them play general managers, half of them play player agents. And we teach them how to brand and market, how to set up a following on TikTok or Instagram. Then we teach them how to set up a charitable foundation, teach them damage control. So I'm trying to help create the next generation of sports professionals that have values and ethics and see the larger purpose of all that. So we do that. I'm in the middle of writing my third book, which is tentatively titled Comeback, Resilience, and What Matters in Life. This program I talked to you about, a major revolution in biomed, where you have these new modalities that can help a player. Most games come down to the fourth quarter or the last drive. And can you help someone stimulate more productivity, focus, and energy in those critical moments? And then can you bring them back to service quicker when they get injured? Now, if that all works, then these same modalities, hyperbaric oxygen, stem cell, red, white, and blue light, NanoV, can really help anybody over the age of 30. And so I think we're going to see longevity extended. People are on the brain. There's a new theory of neuroplasticity where you can grow new neurons and reestablish a brain. There's a process called RTMS and one called Nestri brain training with Tommy Shavers. And they're all designed to have cognitive sharpness and memory in an amazing way. So that's another project I'm working on.
Very cool. Very cool. How rewarding is it for you to be an adjunct professor and to teach the future of America, the youth?
So as I've said, I've spoken on 85 campuses and I continue to speak. I mean, recently I spoke at UCLA and SC by Zoom for the University of Tennessee, University of North Carolina. And you're trying to show people what skills they need and then how to break into the business ultimately. And so the key is how each person distinguishes themselves and separates them out from the mass in a way. So it's branding yourself. It's getting on LinkedIn and hitting every human being involved in sports. It's doing networking. It's writing a blog. It's doing that. So I try, I've got a whole series of speeches yet to come. And then I've taught three times. I taught at UC Irvine in their brand new law school. I taught at Chapman. And I taught at a smaller school, Concordia. So what you're trying to do is to mentor the next generation and help them get centered, establish their own priorities, understand what they're looking for, and how to be more effective.
Very nice. Excellent stuff there. What would you say in your life or your career has been your right moment? What I mean by that, it's a time or place where you wanted to pursue something. You asked somebody for advice. They said, that's a bad idea. You should not pursue that. It's not going to work out. And you said to them, I'm going to do it anyway. And in the end, you will see why it is that I'm right about this.
Well, that was the whole key with the charitable and community programs, which is high school scholarship funds, putting roots down in the community. And other people said, oh, that's not your job. Your job is to make athletes money. And I said, no, my job is to help them develop character and have a lifetime. And so then we'd go back to the colleges. And so Troy Aikman endowed a full scholarship at UCLA. or Warren Moon at University of Washington. And then at the pro level, we challenged him to set up a charitable foundation and pick something in the world they'd like to tackle. So for Warwick Dunn, who grew up with a single mother, it's putting the 200 families into the first home they'll ever own by making a down payment. So my whole career, people have said that that's not none of your business, but I disagree. And I think that one of the dangers in society is the concept of situational ethics. And it's where someone is a good father, good to cats and dogs, a good neighbor, goes out in a workplace, and because it's just business, uses heinous social Darwin tactics, because after all, the end justifies the means. And that bifurcates someone and leads to a type of soul death. So when you're working, you are also living out your important life. And so at the end of the day, what truly matters? I think it's going to be the quality of the relationships that you had. Were you a good father? Were you a good son, a good brother? Were you good to your friends when it cost you something to be a friend? And then what did you leave of value? Did you heal pain? Did you help other people? And that will be a fulfilling life. It's not going to be the amount of money or the newspaper clippings or the rest of that. That all is going to fade.
An amazing all-encompassing strategy to turn people not only to the best possible versions of themselves at home, but away from home. Lee, we appreciate your time. We thank you for doing this with us. At the top, I mentioned you were a best-selling author. You mentioned the fact that you're working on your third book. So before we let you go, I have to mention The Agent, right? My 40-year career making deals and changing the game. You can get it on Amazon. It was published a couple years ago. So I just wanted to talk quickly about, you have a busy schedule, you have a busy life. You know, how do you find time to do all of those things on the side, you know, like make TV appearances, you know, set aside time to, you know, pen your book or work with somebody who helps you put those stories, you know, from up here to paper? You know, how many people in your life outside of your family do you have helping you organize and structure your day, structuring your schedule?
So the answer to how you achieve multiple things is learn how to multitask. So you're on a college campus, you need to study, you got a girlfriend you haven't seen, so you take your girlfriend with you to the library, right? And then can you focus every ounce of energy and attention into this moment? So I don't have my phone here. I don't know what time it is. You mentioned staffing. It's got to be excellent because I lose myself into each moment. So someone has to keep you moving along or you go forever. But it's being present in this moment and realizing this moment that we're all sharing together is every bit as important as every other moment. And that every use of time is all there is. Inexorable retreat of time is something that we don't have the power to fight. So that maximizing everything that you're doing by being focused, you know, put your cell phone down and put, you know, the computer down and get into what's in front of you.
Well, we appreciate all of these moments that Nick and I got to share with you. Again, we thank you for your time. This is an amazing, amazing interview. Somebody that I have a special connection to because one of my favorite movies growing up was Jerry Maguire. And I've always loved shows like Entourage and loved that world. So to have somebody like you come on and do this with us, super special, super important. What we do here is we always give our guests the last word. So you shared a lot, right? A lot of really great words of wisdom. You know, this is the part where we tell our guests, you know, if there's anything else you would like to promote, go ahead. But I don't think I really need to ask you that. So if you have any other terrific last words for us, by all means, go ahead. Thanks again, Lee. Appreciate it.
You know, try to make a positive impact in the world. Try to think about how instead of you can light candles instead of cursing the darkness. And so try to see who you can help today and who you can look out for.
All right, Lee, thank you for your time. That sounds good. If me and Joe ever make it a Radio Row, we'll have to do this again in person. We look forward to meeting you at some point. And that's going to
be interview number 72.
Yeah, 72. That I'm talking about. That's going to do it here for this episode of You Know I'm Right. For our very special guest, Lee Steinberg, for my co-host, Joe Calabrese, I'm Nick Durst, and this has been You Know I'm Right.